Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Why shouldn't you feel safe when you walk into a hospital? Hospitals exist for a benefit of the patient, or they should. And I know that people who work in hospitals, I'm certain, want to do right by the patient. This isn't about evildoers that are trying to hurt you, but they, in fact, will hurt you if you are not vigilant as a patient, and it's just wrong. And so that's where the politics comes into play.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, your hostess and the voice for patient safety. Thank you for joining me. You just heard a snippet from a very important voice within the patient safety world, Leah Binder, who heads the patient safety watchdog called the LeapFrog Group, a national nonprofit that evaluates and reports on the safety and quality performance of hospitals in order to reduce the estimated 440,000 annual deaths from hospital errors, accidents, and injuries. So that is coming up, and you will want to hear from her. Well, today I too want to talk about patient safety from my very real perspective, and I have lots to report. So let's dive right in, because right now it's time for the healthcare hazards of the week. I mentioned last week that my mom is in the hospital, and I talked about some crazy emergency room experiences, such as an ER staff saving urine in the sink for 7 hours because she felt it important to disclose to me that the lab consistently loses urine samples, or the emergency room chest x-ray technician who failed to tell the gal across the hall to remove her bra prior to the x-ray, then had to come back and radiate her again to avoid the metal in the bra straps. Or the nurse who refused to tend to my mom's potential bedsore site. Or the intensive care unit nurse who spent 2 solid hours on the computer booking her vacation instead of answering patients' call buttons. And the following week, as Sonny and Cher so eloquently put it, the beat goes on. More of the same. And don't get me wrong, 95% of the people and experiences were absolutely great. But the remaining few percent of the time, things were downright scary. And in reality, it's that small window of time when people don't follow protocol or when systems don't work. It's those times that cause patient harm or death. And one of my main concerns is the wanton disregard for hand washing. Seriously. I seldom saw anyone enter the hospital room and wash their hands. Many did use a squirt of the hand sanitizer on the wall as they exited the room, but never upon entering. One of the most egregious of times is when a nurse, who told me she was very aware of hand washing, donned a pair of gloves, helped my mom go to the bathroom, adjusted the bandage on her backside that was there for preventive bedsore measures, and then proceeded to pick up mom's food tray from the tray table to remove it from the room, taking it far down the hallway. Believe me, I stopped her and I asked, "Aren't you going to remove your gloves?" She turned around quickly, kind of scared that I caught her, and replied, "Oh, don't worry, I'm just taking this tray to the soiled dish room," and off she went. Would she have to use the doorknob of the soiled dish room to get in? Would she by chance touch something else along the way? And what about the person who goes into the soiled dish room to pick up the trays? Does the bacteria from our nurse's gloves transfer to the tray and then to the other trays that stack upon it? To the hands or gloves of the person who picks up the trays? Apparently no one follows the trail like I do. But in reality, the trail is there. A trail of bacteria from my mom in the bathroom to the kitchen and most likely back to some other patient's room. And this kind of thing went on and on and on, everyone touching everything, using the gloves to protect themselves and not the patient or the environment. So if you or someone you know or visit is in the hospital, Keep an eye out for this kind of cross-contamination and feel free to speak up. I'd be interested to hear what kind of response you get. Now let's talk about communication, the lack of or miscommunication, because that is a giant problem. Here's one example of lack of communication. Upon discharge from the hospital to a rehabilitation facility, the discharge nurse came into mom's room with a packet. She pulled out the sheet with the medications and said, "These are the medications you'll be taking at rehab. Follow up with your primary care physician in 2 to 3 weeks, and yep, you're all set to go." Now, prior to her coming in, when I found out that mom was being discharged, I asked for someone to print off a copy of her current medications. So I already had an opportunity to take a look at them prior to the discharge nurse's visit. And it's a good thing I did that, because as I read through the list of drugs, I found one that I hadn't heard of before. Temazepam or Restoril. I asked the discharge nurse, "What is this?" "Oh, just something to help her sleep." So I asked mom, "Are you having a difficult time falling asleep?" "No." "Did anyone tell you that they were giving you a sleeping pill?" "No." I asked the nurse, "Who prescribed this and when?" She checked and said that the cardiologist ordered it and that it hadn't been given to her yet, but would start once at rehab. "Oh, no, it won't," I told her. "Let's get that removed from the list right now. And by the way, what is this medication?" I asked her. "Another strange one on the list." "Oh, that's Ambien, another sleep aid." "Really? 2 sleep aids prior to entering rehab? Is that to knock the patients out so that everything is quiet at night?" "Take that off the list too," I told her. When I looked these drugs up, I didn't like what I learned. Temazepam or Restoril is a benzodiazepine sedative hypnotic used to treat insomnia symptoms such as trouble falling or staying asleep. Common side effects include dizziness, daytime drowsiness during the hours when you're not normally sleeping, amnesia or forgetfulness, muscle weakness, loss of balance or coordination, headache, blurred vision, depression, nervousness, excitability, irritability, nausea, vomiting, stomach discomfort, dry mouth, increased thirst, numbness, burning pain, or tingly feelings. Whoa. Ambien is a member of the class of medications known as hypnotics and carries another set of unwanted side effects. Especially ridiculous because my mom never complained of not being able to sleep. Or perhaps she did mention that it was difficult to sleep because of the noise outside in the hallway, or because the staff turned on the overhead lights in the middle of the night to wake her, uncover her to take blood, and then exit the room, leaving her uncovered, shivering and staring at bright lights. Or perhaps she couldn't sleep because every morning between 4 and 4:30 a.m., someone woke her to give her a bath so that the day shift wouldn't have to be bothered. Moral of the story. When in the hospital and someone asks you if you are having difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, don't say yes unless you really have a rough time and not due to the environment. Make that distinction so that you are not given unwanted drugs to make you sleep. And this just underscores the necessity of having someone designated as your advocate, another set of eyes and ears and a mouth to speak up for you. I mean, who could speak up for themselves when under the influence of these high-powered addictive drugs? Drugging patients unnecessarily is not safe, and it's certainly not healthy. And while talking about communication, lack of follow-through falls into this category too. It's so easy to get lost in the shuffle. You ask a nurse a question. She doesn't know the answer, but will have so-and-so get back to you. So-and-so never does, so you ask someone else, and on it goes for days and days until you become the pain in the butt, always asking questions. But believe me, it pays off. Mom got discharged to a rehabilitation facility, and it's during these handoff times when your care gets transferred from one place to another that things can get mixed up if someone is not on top of everything. Medications are the very first thing you should have on your radar as you move from place to place. Ask for a list of discharge medications, and once settled into your new location, cross-check everything with the new admitting nurse. And then as you receive each medication, cross-check with your discharge list. Here's a communication mix-up that I still haven't resolved. A few days into my mom's stay at rehab, a nurse came into the room to tell us that she just received orders for a nephrologist consult. and that would indicate that something was up with her kidneys. The nurse asked me, "Would you like to be here for the consultation?" "Yes, of course," I answered. "When will it be?" I don't know," she answered. "Well," I asked, "who ordered the consultation?" I don't know." "Okay, then." The next day, no nephrology consultation. The day after that, no nephrology consultation. On the third day, I asked the nurse, "When are we going to have this nephrology consultation? Because if something is going on with her kidneys, we probably shouldn't be waiting 3 days to talk about it." "Well, let me check on that for you." Next day, still no answer. So I asked again. And later that day, someone from medical records called my radio studio phone line and left a message. How they got that number, when my personal home phone number was clearly posted on Mom's whiteboard in her room in case of an emergency, it's beyond me how they got my studio line. The message said, "Hi, Pat, this is Susie in medical records. I understand that you requested a nephrology consultation. Who do you want as her doctor? Do you have someone in mind? Or should I look through the phone book and pick someone?" Oh, I kid you not. That was the message. I didn't request a consultation, and no, I don't want a random phone book doctor. So the next day I went in and asked again, and this went on for days until I was able to corner a nurse and insist that I see the chart. Sure enough, there was a cryptic note written by who knows who because it wasn't signed by anyone. My mom's name wasn't even on it, and it said nephrology consultation. The nurse quietly said to me, "I hate to say this, but I don't think this is for your mom. I think someone wrote it in the wrong chart." Oh, how's that for feeling safe? So there you can see how so much can get mixed up, go unanswered, create unwanted consultations, tests, bills, and potentially cause patient harm. That's unbelievable, right? And this leads me to the subject of picking a place to rehabilitate after a hospital stay. If you think you may land in a hospital in the somewhat near future, do yourself a huge favor and check out some places ahead of time, like now. Because when the time comes to discharge you, you or your family do not want to pick a name out of a list the hospital provides for you. You really must physically go to each place, take a tour, and separate the hyped-up marketing talk for what your gut tells you. And even then, you won't be able to tell completely how your experience will be, but at least you'll have the opportunity to ask questions ahead of time and compare several places. I mean, you surely don't want to make a bad decision and cause yourself harm. Well, we did that 8 years ago when I picked a place right around the corner from my home. Convenient, yes, and they nearly killed us at every turn. And I promised that I would never do that again. So please heed my advice. Check the internet for some local places, check out their reviews, ask around, and make an appointment for a tour. Even the place I picked for my mom right now, it's new, it's clean, the people are super friendly and nice. But here's a question that I didn't ask during our tour, and I'm sure had I asked, I would have been given some pre-washed answer anyway. But here's the question. What happens to the quality of patient care when the staff calls off and you suddenly find yourself short-staffed? How's that for a question? I don't know what I'd expect the proper answer to be, but it really is a valid and important question. On Easter Sunday, Bob and I went to have Easter lunch with Mom, and we stayed until about 3 in the afternoon. Because I was there for lunch, I decided not to go in 2 more hours at dinner time, which I usually do so that I can wheel her to the dining room to eat with her newfound buddies. So at about 7 o'clock, I called her room to check on her, and no answer. No worries. Often after dinner, a group of them convene in the TV lounge to watch television together. I called back at 8, and then again at 9. And by that time, I was getting concerned and decided at 9:30 to call one more time before calling the nurse's station. Well, Mom answered, and she said that Nurse Lulu was just now putting her to bed. After Lulu left, Mom and I talked, and she told me that there was only one person on the floor to get everyone back to their rooms. So she had to sit in the TV room for 3 hours, despite the fact that she was tired and falling asleep and wanted to go to bed. And then all of a sudden there was panic in her voice. "Oh no," she said, "it's dark in here, and Nurse Lulu didn't give me my call button. They're always in such a hurry." Well, my mom is a fall risk, so there's no way she could get out of bed in the dark to search for her call button. Don't worry, I told her. I'll call the desk and have someone come in right now. Well, now that sounds like a simple task, eh? I hung up with Mom and called the desk. Once, twice, 5 times, 10 times, 12 times. And it rang about 30 times each time. And then it would disconnect. I called my mom back, but she didn't answer. Probably couldn't find the phone in the dark. At that point, I headed to my closet to get out of my PJs and drive over to the place myself. One more call, I thought, before I do that. After 25 rings, someone finally picked up. And when I explained what was going on, the gal said, "Oh, we can't hear the phone when we're down the hall, and the portable one doesn't work." Wow. One person tending to all of these people, trying to answer phones? It wasn't anyone's fault, except the administration. Hire a chimp to answer the phones so that the only nurse in town doesn't have to run around like a lunatic and leave at-risk patients in the dark without a call button all night. There's a big difference between when being short-staffed is an inconvenience to the patient, leaving them to wait 3 hours in a TV room, versus a patient safety concern, leaving a fall patient in bed in the dark all night without a way to call for help. Now that's a serious patient safety issue. And I tell you these stories as a way to exemplify real-life situations that you may encounter in the hopes that you can use them to help guide you through a similar journey. I cannot stress enough the need to visit these types of facilities ahead of time to see for yourself, to ask questions, talk to the residents, to come up with a decision ahead of time. Now, you've heard on this program, we talk about the Welsh Home in Rocky River. They are a rehabilitation facility that you may want to add to your list to check out. You can call them for a tour, and here's the phone number, 440-331-0420, 440-331-0420. Ask for Sarah or Lauren and tell them that you heard about them on Speak Up and Stay Alive. The Welsh Home is located on Center Ridge Road in Rocky River, right across the street from the Giant Eagle. Now, obviously, I cannot personally attest to the quality of care since I don't have firsthand experience, but I did take a tour and met some residents, and everyone seemed to be happy. So check it out for yourself and make your own informed decision. Please, do that now. Don't wait until a hospital stay arrives and then you're forced to make a blind decision. Call the Welsh Home, 440-331-0420. And you certainly do not have to be Welsh to use their services. Now, last for today, I want to touch on dietary needs. Just like medication mix-ups, your special dietary needs may get overlooked, especially within the first few days of your stay at a rehab facility. My mom is on a low-sodium diet to help manage her congestive heart failure. Too much salt creates a fluid overload, fluid around her lungs that need to be removed, swollen feet, and extra work for her heart. When they gave her a menu with bologna and ham on it, cottage cheese and other salty items, I asked, "Do you have a menu that specifically states the sodium content per serving?" Well, you would have think I had asked for a circus clown and a Ferris wheel. No, we don't have that. But everything here is low sodium. After 8 years of label studying, I know about low sodium. For example, 1 tablespoon of regular soy sauce has 920 milligrams of sodium. 1 tablespoon of low-sodium soy sauce has 575 milligrams. So in this case, the low-sodium version is in fact lower than the regular one, but by no means is it low-sodium. So for us to take their word that everything they make is low-sodium was a huge leap of faith for me. Low-sodium compared to what? Based on what numbers? Doesn't seem like an unusual question now, does it? And now here's when I really began to doubt the wisdom of the dietitian. As she was assuring me that everything was low sodium, she also divulged her secret ingredient for her desserts and other menu items that needed a bit of sweetness. Splenda. I use Splenda in everything, she touted. Whoa, I didn't say a word. As she was so enthusiastic and proud, I couldn't bring myself to question her sensibility. We all know artificial sweeteners like Splenda are just that. Artificial. They're synthetic. Let's talk about this for a minute because it's important. So what exactly is Splenda? Splenda is the commercial name for sucralose. The manufacturers advertise Splenda as being more natural than other sweeteners, as the main substance, sucralose, comes from sugar. But this is not really true. The way that sucralose is produced is to chlorinate sugar. Sucralose is made by replacing three of the select hydrogen-oxygen groups on sucrose, which is table sugar molecules, and to replace that with three chlorine atoms. Becomes a chlorocarbon. Other common chlorocarbons include carbon tetrachloride and methylene chloride, which are all poisonous. Chlorine has been proven as toxic to our bodies and can accumulate in our systems over time, and our bodies are not made to recognize these substances and do not know how to properly deal with them. And here's where it gets scary. Sucralose accumulates very slowly within our bodies and is not fully excreted. This means chlorine is being stored in your body, causing your cells to become toxic. Studies in rats show that in amounts of 500 milligrams of sucralose becomes hepatotoxic and nephrotoxic, meaning that it causes damage to the liver and kidneys. And those studies are not taken seriously by the good old FDA, as they say the test subjects were rats. So let's test it on unsuspecting humans forced to eat it in rehab before we take heed. The FDA routinely approves a lot of things that are later pulled off the market once enough people die, like cyclamates and Vioxx. A 2008 Duke University study found that Splenda alters the intestine flora as it destroys beneficial fecal bacteria. Now, to me, that is a very important finding, especially relevant to people living in a rehabilitation facility where they also may be taking antibiotics. Because if Splenda is destroying our good bacteria and antibiotics are also destroying our good bacteria, this makes for a perfect C. diff storm. Combine a ravaged gut, now devoid of any good bacteria, coupled with poor hand-washing protocol, which we know is everywhere, and you've got the ideal situation to bring on the diarrhea and bring on C. diff. We've talked about C. diff before. Many, many, many people die of C. diff in hospitals and rehabilitation centers. And I bet the dietitian has no idea what I'm talking about here. Splenda was downgraded from safe to caution in 2013 after an Italian animal study linked sucralose to higher risk of developing leukemia. In fact, the Center for Science in the Public Interest, their executive director, Michael F. Jacobson, said, "Sucralose may prove to be safer than saccharin and aspartame, but the forthcoming Italian study warrants careful scrutiny before we can be confident that the sweetener is safe for use in food." Other studies have determined that sucralose is not a biologically inert compound, having possible toxic effects, including the creation of dioxin-like compounds when sucralose is heated. Now, even though Splenda is marketed as being suitable for baking purposes, no human toxicity studies have been done on the thermal breakdown products of sucralose. And guess who makes Splenda? Yep, Johnson & Johnson, whom I reported on a few weeks ago. This is interesting. Splenda's original tagline was, "Made from sugar, so it tastes like sugar." Well, that was food for a lawsuit and was found to be misleading. So currently, Splenda is advertised with the slogan, "It starts with sugar, it tastes like sugar, but it's not sugar." Well, now they're telling the truth. It is not sugar. Wow. Even the Sugar Association complaint to the Federal Trade Commission stated that Splenda is not a natural product. It is not cultivated or grown, and it does not occur in nature. Many people report the side effects as resembling allergic reactions. The most commonly reported Splenda side effects are migraines, dizziness, intestinal cramping, rashes, acne, headaches, bloating, chest pain, ringing in the ears, gum bleeding, and the list goes on. So there you have it. Splenda does not have any long-term research, and we know by its chemical makeup that it's not good for you. Too much chlorine in your system is toxic, and there are healthier natural sweeteners available today like whole leaf stevia or local honey. Now, wouldn't you expect that a registered dietitian would know this? And as I sit with my mom during mealtimes, I watch some of these residents eating three and four desserts at one sitting, chlorinating their already weak and fragile little bodies and immune systems. It really makes me sick to watch. And I'm sure before it's all over, I'll be saying something to the dietitian, bringing this to her attention. Now I bet you're thinking, wow, Pat and her mom sure have some wild experiences. But guess what? These kind of things go on all of the time, in the background, unless someone other than the patient is keeping a vigil eye on the situation. These patient safety issues aren't just finding me, they're finding you too. Only perhaps you don't know it. So once again, I retell these experiences with the hope that you too will be mindful and watchful during your healthcare or hospital experiences. You may not get a second chance to speak up, so please pay attention and use your voice. As I always say, you have to speak up and stay alive.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio is proud to introduce our most recent sponsor, Zoar Village Golf Course. Find out more at speakupandstayalive.com.
For years now, a lot of you have been driving down I-77 to play at Zoar Village Golf Course. Thank you for the 40 years of support. And if you haven't been here, we'd like to invite you to come see why we've been called a must-play course for Northeast Ohio golfers. Superintendent Eric Crone's greens are always stellar, too. The pro shop is stocked and the snack bar features great food. Check us out at Zoar Village golf.com.
You are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, always scouting the planet for a guest with something to say to improve your day. And today's guest fits that description. She is Leah Binder, the president and CEO of the Leapfrog Group, a not-for-profit organization whose mission is to increase transparency at hospitals and healthcare systems and improve safety, quality, and affordability. Under her leadership, the Leapfrog Group launched the Hospital Safety Score, and we've talked about that on the show many times before, which assigns letter grades assessing the safety of general hospitals across the country. Leah has been named on Modern Healthcare's national list of the top 25 women in healthcare in 2013, as well as their annual list of the 100 most influential people in healthcare since 2009. She sits on numerous national boards and councils and serves as a regular contributor to Forbes.com, The Huffington Post, and The Wall Street Journal online expert forum. She's been cited by Becker's as one of the nation's leading experts leading the field of patient safety in 2013. So it doesn't get any better than this. Welcome to the show, Leah.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I want to start right off the bat and ask you, why is your organization called the Leapfrog Group?
Our founders wanted giant leaps forward in the quality and safety of hospital care. And they wanted something that would distinguish them from the crowd of acronyms that we're used to in healthcare. It seems like everything in healthcare is an acronym. It's hard to make an acronym out of Leapfrog.
Well, it's a memorable name. Yes, it is. So under your leadership, the Leapfrog Group launched the Hospital Safety Score, which assigns letter grades assessing the safety of hospitals across the country. But there are other groups touting the same type of evaluation, sometimes with very different outcomes. So as a consumer, this can be confusing. Are the Leapfrog Group scores more reliable, or should we look at multiple sources to help us find a solution?
Well, you can look at multiple sources to understand a rating of a hospital. The hospital safety score, though, is the only system that looks at the errors and accidents and injuries in hospitals. We're laser focused on patient safety. We are not looking, for example, at what are your chances of doing well in an orthopedic surgery at a hospital, for example. Mm-hmm. We are looking at what's the rate of infection and does the hospital have the right protocols in place to prevent the medical errors that can kill people and do kill people every day in hospitals. So we're laser focused on safety. And what we like to say to people is safety first. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you look at when you are looking for a hospital to seek care from, the first thing you look at is it safe? And so you go to our hospital safety score to get that idea. And then you have other questions. Is the doctor good? What's the quality of the procedures, et cetera? And there are many other rating systems that can provide you with that information. So definitely avail yourself of the rich array of information that's out there rating hospitals, but safety should come first. So start with the hospital safety score.
So you've done all the work, and the consumer just goes to the site and they can see very quickly. If they want to delve further into it, they can, but that single score gives them an idea of what the safety level.
We use 28 different measures to come up with the score. So you can pick a measure that's interesting to you, and you can see how that hospital compared to the best hospital in the country and the worst hospital in the country and the average hospital. So there's a commitment to 100% transparency in the way this information is presented to you, but also in an accessible way, so that if you're in a hurry and you don't have time to study every single detail about a hospital's safety record, you can certainly interpret an A, B, C, D, or F pretty quickly to give you the indication you need. And you can do it on an app, by the way.
Oh.
So if you're on the ambulance and they say, where to? Take a look at our app. It's free. It's a hospital safety score app. It's on Android or iPhone. And that will tell you the grades of hospitals either in the vicinity of where you're standing, or you can search wherever you want.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is the gold standard resource then.
That's what we think.
Yeah. Give us your website early on here, just so that our listeners could write this down a couple times in case they don't get a chance later.
Sure. HospitalSafetyScore.org.
Okay. Your other website is leapfroggroup.org, or is that two different ones?
Right. Okay. They're two different websites, but you each connects with each other.
Okay.
So leapfroggroup.org is our main website.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. All right. I've studied your website in great detail many times, and I'm thrilled to see the hidden surcharge calculator on the website. I thought that was really cool. It's kind of a door into the secret world of charges for medical errors that you won't find on your bill in bold capital letters. You're not going to say, hey, this is a medical error, and here's how much you're paying for it, folks. However, these hidden surcharges are there. So tell us about that.
Well, here's the bizarre thing about the healthcare industry that's so different from other industries. When you experience an error in a hospital, so when you're the victim of poor care or a mistake, when you're the victim of a mistake, you will pay more. So that's a bizarre thing when you think about other industries. Do you go into an auto dealership? How would you react if the salesperson said to you, well, that car costs $1,000 more because the seatbelts don't work? You know, it's unthinkable, right? You don't pay more for worse quality. But in healthcare, when a mistake is made, the costs of that mistake are almost always passed on to the consumer one way or another. Usually we don't see it directly, but it happens. So there was a study done in JAMA, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association, extremely prestigious medical journal, and they researched a hospital system and all the billing records in that hospital system, and it took months and months for them to figure this out. But they wanted to know, when there was a surgical site infection in that hospital system, how much money did payers pay for it? And they found that Medicaid patients and Medicaid paid about $900 to that hospital system every time there was a surgical site infection, an extra amount. That's the surcharge they paid. They found that Medicare paid $3,000. So those are a lot of money to pay for something that you don't want to have happen. But here's the part that got our attention. That study also found that purchasers, which is my membership, these are employers and other purchasers of health benefits who spend millions and millions of dollars on health benefits to their employees, the purchasers were paying, in this study, $39,000 for the privilege of a surgical site infection.
Mm.
$39,000. You can create a good job with $39,000. Mm-hmm. So you can go in. It's a free calculator for anyone to use. It's on the Leapfrog Group website. It's a hidden surcharge, Americans Pay for Hospital Errors, a calculator. You can plug in your own numbers or have your health plan do it. A lot of purchasers have been having their health plan come in and enter their numbers. But in any way you do it, again, 100% transparency. We show you the spreadsheet and how we came up with it, what research we used, et cetera. But what you will find for most purchasers is that they are spending millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in surcharges for the privilege of harm to their employees.
I learned about this the difficult way when my mom was in the hospital 4 years ago for a shoulder replacement, and there was a medical error, spent the next 4 months in the hospital. Mm. So what should have been a very simple procedure ended out being 4 months later and a $2.5 million hospital bill.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
And that's when I thought, okay, somebody's getting paid a lot of money here for all of these adverse events. And several of them were what would be considered your old-timey never events. I mean, we had a pressure sore, stage 4 to the bone.
Ugh.
Well, speaking of that, that kind of encompasses the patient experience. And I'm in the process of writing an article about the patient experience, gathering perspectives from previous guests. And maybe you can share your answer with us. The question is, what does the patient experience mean to you?
What the patient says it is. Period. Not what the nurse says it is, not what the hospital administrator says it is, not what Leah Binder says it is, what the patient says it is. We never ask patients what they think, and we don't engage them appropriately, typically, we don't engage them appropriately in decision-making around how healthcare is delivered. Their voices are pretty much silent in Washington policy circles. That's not only because there's no effort to engage patients, because I think there is some, mm-hmm. It's just that it's an intimidating environment for a survivor of an incident in a hospital to sit in a table with, 20 physicians with, 100 letters after their name, and they seem to know what they're talking about in healthcare. For them to sit there and be the one voice of the patient is an incredibly intimidating environment. So if a provider really wants to understand patient experience, they're going to have to sit down as a human being, not as a physician, not as a titled member of the establishment in healthcare, but as a human being, a father or son or daughter or a wife, sit down with a patient and find out what happened and find out what their perception of their experience is, where they fell through the gaps, what happened, how they saw what happened, and listen with an open mind and think through what can be done to address that. I heard a fantastic leader in patient safety at a hospital system, a MedStar system, said that we listened to our patients who said that when there's a bad thing that happens in our hospital, we felt like we were completely in the dark because all the providers were running around trying to address the problem, but everybody ignored us and it was frightening and we felt completely left out and we couldn't help. So this system took the right approach. If you really want to understand patient experience, you listen to that story. And you don't address it like, well, of course they were busy. They were trying to save this patient's life. You don't address it with an answer. You address it with a question. What could we do better? Mm-hmm. And they did. They said, from now on, the policy is you must sit down with the patient's family within 30 minutes of any incident, even if you have no answer, even if it's just we don't know. So that is, to me, an example of being truly patient-centered, listening to the patient experience, because the only thing that matters about the patient experience is what the patient thinks they want,
mm-hmm.
the patient's experience.
And wouldn't it be great if we could maybe address what the patient experience means to each individual patient and their family prior to there being an incident so that we could know what is it? Because everybody comes to the healthcare scene with a different set of expectations and experiences. So somehow it would be nice if there was that conversation right up front.
Patients are not familiar with the healthcare system. So for a lot of patients, they come into the health system, they have no idea what to expect. For example, when I had a baby, that was the first time I actually stayed in the hospital, was when I had a baby. If you had asked me beforehand, what do I want? Because I kind of shopped around for hospitals when I was pregnant. One thing I didn't think of was, I don't want people interrupting me every 5 minutes with something. It never would have occurred to me that that would happen. But at this hospital, they had somebody come in to take a picture of the baby, and then somebody come in to take my blood pressure, and somebody else come in to give me some medicine, and somebody else. I was never able to sleep. That made that experience terrible for me. I would never have predicted that in advance of the stay, but afterward I could certainly tell you. So basically I think that hospitals have to be in a continuous stage of listening to patients so that the next time someone comes in, they can predict and do better.
Oh, that's good. I like that, a continuous stage. Excellent. So what's on your hot topic list these days?
Well, I am very interested in how the movement for transparency is going to play out. I think that we must get consumers more involved in making decisions about their own care and pushing on providers to do what's right for the patient. Right now, we do not have a healthcare system where patients have any voice. Hospitals, I know, are not accustomed to thinking from the perspective of the patient on their actions. We see things every day that hospitals do that just make no sense from the point of view of the patient, but make a lot of sense from the point of view of hospitals. We need that voice so badly, it's hard to even stress it enough. We need the voice not just at the individual level when you're admitted to a hospital, but before that, from a political perspective. You know, there's efforts in Washington every day that I spend a lot of my time on to suppress data on quality and safety that is from CMS, meaning the agency that does Medicare, to suppress that data from being publicly reported. The fact is that the biggest voices here in Washington on health policy are providers. They have a very significant stake, as you can imagine, in what happens with health policy. But so do consumers. And consumers have got to get their voice heard. So I think one thing that LeapFrog has really focused its attention on is alerting the public there is a major hazard to their health, which is safety, and there are things you can do about it at the individual level and at the political level. And really, that's been our focus, is to try to find many new ways to engage different consumers.
Great, great. And that was going to lead me to my next question, was how can patients and family members help improve their hospital experience?
On our website, hospitalsafetyscore.org, we have some information for consumers and some resources they can look for. I know there are other patient safety organizations that offer resources as well. There are things you can look for and ways you can act when you're in a hospital that will protect you. And the fundamental and probably the most important tip we give consumers is to try, if you can, to have an advocate with you as much as possible when you're a patient. 24 hours would be good. 24 hours a day would be good.
Yep.
But if you can't get that, just as often as possible. And that person should feel emboldened to ask tons of questions on your behalf. So what medication, nurse, what medication are you giving right now and in what dose? And make sure that your advocate understands how that fits with your overall medication regimen. Check everything. Ask every question. Make sure everyone's washing their hands before they touch the patient, et cetera. There are just fundamental things that your advocate can do. And if you don't have an advocate, you have to do it for yourself. And it's pretty tough when you're lying in that hospital bed with that Johnny on. But you may have to do it. And the option that no consumer should think that they have is to go into a hospital and just assume that everything will be taken care of. That's not an option.
You are singing our song. That's what this show is all about, to try to empower folks and inform them and let them know basically what the hazards are, how and why they happen, and what they can do about them.
But it's not right. I hate giving the advice because it's just not right. Why shouldn't you feel safe when you walk into a hospital? Hospitals exist for the benefit of the patient, or they should. And I know the people who work in hospitals, I'm certain, want to do right by the patient. This isn't about evildoers that are trying to hurt you, but they, in fact, will hurt you if you are not vigilant as a patient, and it's just wrong. And so that's where the politics comes into play. We have to be sure that our legislators know we have high expectations for how our money, our taxpayer money, is used to invest in healthcare. You know, most of what's spent in healthcare comes from taxpayers. So yeah, we don't have a single payer system. We don't have that in the United States. But most of what's paid for is out of Medicare or Medicaid or federal or employees insurance, et cetera. Most of it's paid for by taxpayers. So you have a right to demand that we know how hospitals are doing, how doctors are doing, in exchange for our investment. Those are the kinds of political arguments that we need consumers to get engaged with.
Wow, that's powerful. How can we learn more about you and what you do?
Well, come on our website, leapfroggroup.org. You can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll keep you informed. Lots of ways to get involved with what we're doing. And also, you can go to hospitalsafetyscore.org. You can look up hospitals. When you look up a hospital that you've gone to or that your doctor has recommended you go to, and you see that it didn't get, well, you see anything about it, whether it's an A, B, C, D, or F, go to your doctor and say, I noticed that the hospital that you performed surgery in or that you recommended to me got a C. Do you know what they're doing to improve their safety? Because that's really important to me. That simple conversation can have ramifications for future patients. So you can make a difference just with that simple conversation. Because right now, basically, hospitals do not think patients care about safety. And that's true for the hospitals that are actually doing a good job with safety. They don't do it because they think the patients will care. They do it because they think it's the right thing and they're just dedicated. But in fact, they also need to know that their market cares, that patients care. And the only way for them to know that is if we speak up.
Oh, that's beautiful. And both of your websites are on our website as well. And we promote LeapFrog Group all the time because doing a super job, and it's a great resource for our listeners. Well, Leah, it's been a pleasure to get to know you and find out a little bit more about the LeapFrog Group and how you can help our listeners have a safer experience and an outcome. And I really appreciate your being here today.
It was my pleasure, and thank you so much for all your good work and your exposing this important issue with your show.
Make a splash with a season pass that screams fun. Pioneer Waterland and Drive Fun Park in Chardon, Ohio has discounted season passes. Buy now and save. Family pass for $4, $195. Additional family member and individual passes discounted too. That includes a free parking pass for the entire season. Order your season passes today at pioneerwaterland.com or by phone 440-285-5200. That's 440-285-5200. Do you or a loved one need to rehabilitate after a hospital stay and don't know where to go? With so many choices, how do you safely choose? Well, I have the answer. The Welsh Home, located in Rocky River, Ohio. Let's spend the next 2 minutes with Lauren Teschner to get some advice. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Lauren, how does the Welsh Home help patients transition back home?
We establish goals on day one of them admitting to the Welsh Home and make sure that they can reach those goals before they go home. And we do that through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, nursing needs, and also the social work piece of it. We have a social worker on staff who's going to make sure that the patient is safe to go home, make sure that they have all the equipment in their home that they're going to need once they return home, and make sure that it's going to be a successful transition. We would never want to transition someone back to their home that we knew was not going to succeed. So we want to make sure that we do our best to accomplish their goals for a safe return home.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
You're welcome.
The Welsh Home offers state-of-the-art skilled rehabilitation therapy on-site to meet the individual needs of each and every resident. Whether you are looking for short-term or long-term care, the Welsh Home can help. And you don't have to be Welsh to call the Welsh Home your home. Call them to arrange for a tour. 440-331-0420. That's 440-331-0420. Or visit welshhome.com. You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. At the end of another program filled with ideas to help you survive a healthcare or hospital encounter. And I just love our guest today, Leah Binder from the LeapFrog Group. She's not afraid to tell it like it is, and I think her message today resonates quite well with my hazard of the week. Bottom line, you really do have to be proactive. Have someone with you during critical times to act as your advocate, and finally, to pull that voice out of you and speak up. You have every right to protect yourself, and the only way you can do that is by asking questions and speaking up. That's precisely why I wrote the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide, to give others a resource, a tool, to help unravel some of the mysteries surrounding a hospital stay. If you don't have a copy, you really do need to get your very own signed copy. And even if you learn just one thing, it might save your life. I outlined over 17 different hospital hazards that you may encounter and have a special chapter for women, children, veterans, seniors. It really should be on your must-read list. And you can purchase at the website speakupandstayalive.com. speakupandstayalive.com. Visit the shop page. And for $19.95 plus a few dollars shipping, you'll be on your way to a safer healthcare journey. Or you can order by phone. Just call 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. And leave a message on my studio line. And another resource is our live speaking events. I'm happy to come to your group's location to talk about ways to stay safe, ways to improve the patient experience, patient safety tips. There's always a lot to talk about. So just call me to discuss the few details. 440-725-5462. And be sure to come back next week. Who knows what will happen between now and then that I must share with you. So that's next week. The same time, same place. But you know me, never the same information. And remember, Contact the Welsh Home to schedule a tour of their rehabilitation facility this week. 440-331-0420. 440-331-0420. Until we meet again, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Speak Up and Stay Alive, five simple words that address a complex problem, and that is your safety when it comes to every healthcare or hospital encounter, or the safety of your family and friends. These words need to be in your mind and on your lips. And to help with that, I wrote the book Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Hospital Survival Guide, on the recommended reading list of the U.S. Army's Medical Department Office of Quality Management. And it should be on your reading list too. Get a copy for yourself. Give some away as important gifts. Bring the book to the hospital with you. Lay it on the tray table. Now, without saying a word, everyone knows that you are an e-patient, equipped, and eager to get out unharmed. You can purchase online for only $19.95 at the website speakupandstayalive.com or call me and order by phone 440-725-5462. That's speakupandstayalive.com or 440-725-5462. Speak Up and Stay Alive. The book tells you how, and I hope you do.